The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering troubleshooting and repair services for broken or problematic Macs, iPads, and iPhones, both in warranty and out. More information at TechServe.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. You heard the sound at the top of the hour, a bombing in the midst of a crowd in Ankara, Turkey's capital. Turkey's worst terrorist attack in its modern history. Is it Turkey's 9/11? Is it a turning point in modern Turkish history? A pair of suicide bombings kills or wounds 600 people, nearly 100 dead at the scene of a peaceful rally in the capital and a crowded train station. Reports say ISIS may have been responsible, but there are a number of suspect parties with an axe to grind with the Turkish regime. The Kurdish radicals, the PKK, people with opposition party sympathies who want to see President Recep Tayyip Erdogan lose further power in upcoming parliamentary elections. No groups have claimed responsibility for the atrocity at this point, but civilian demonstrators are shouting thief, murderer, Erdogan, charging that the president failed to protect his own citizens. All of this taking place before a backdrop of mourning and grief all over the nation. Joining us now once again is Elmira Beyrasli, author of From the Other Side of the World, Extraordinary Entrepreneurs, Unlikely Places. She's co-founder of Foreign Policy Interrupted. Elmira, welcome.
Thanks for having me, John.
This is a sad day.
It's very, very heartbreaking. I'm usually stoic, but I have to say it was a very hard weekend.
And this kind of feeling of vulnerability in Turkey is new for this generation?
For this generation, it has. I think Turkey has gone through a lot of crises during the 1970s and 1980s. But certainly for the past 20 years, I think Turkey has only seen positive growth, economic growth, a stable government with the ruling Justice and Development Party, known by the initials AKP, ruling uninterrupted in Turkey for the past 13 years. What we saw happen on Saturday, I think, exemplifies the growing polarization in Turkey and this growing fissure between people who support Erdogan, people who don't support Erdogan, and just people who want to promote their own political point of view.
You know, I can't do forensics in this sort of thing, but the fact that neither ISIS nor the PKK have claimed responsibility for this, and both of those groups are known for not being hesitant to come in and claim responsibility for something like this, suggests either that they're not responsible, and this is something really internal in Turkey, or everybody understands that this is a huge event that opens a whole different kind of can of responses.
Well, I think, yes, you're right. No one has claimed responsibility, but I think here, I think the focus has been on the government and what the government has failed to do. The government failed to provide adequate security on Saturday for a rally where thousands of people were expected to come.
And because it was an anti-government rally, a call for peace, something sort of critical of President Erdogan, perhaps the security was lax or something like that.
And a lot of people have criticized the government for not providing adequate security on it. And then the subsequent responses by the government officials saying that there were no security lapses. I think a lot of people in Turkey are angry. I think the conduct of the government has been one of warmongering. Erdogan has always taken on this combative style. He's always played the underdog and the victim in Turkey, where he's had to battle whether it's the Turkish generals or the Turkish elite and represent the common man in Turkey, what he calls the Black Turk. And he has really gained a lot of political power and because of that particular position. But what's happening now is that in order to hold on to power, he's appealing to Turkish nationalists and attacking minorities in Turkey and willfully bringing Turkey into what is essentially a two-front war, one with the Kurds and then one with Islamic extremists on the border with Syria.
What do you make of this Reuters report that suggests that Turkish intelligence may have given explosives and weapons to ISIS at some point in the past and that that may be the reason why there are reports out of Ankara that this is an ISIS-organized attack?
Certainly, there have been indications that the Erdogan government has previously supported extremists in Syria that were against Assad. Erdogan has not, you know, he's made it very clear that he's very anti-Assad and would like the removal of Assad in Syria. And that, you know, I think people know that very well. I think right now what we're seeing right now is all of the actions that Erdogan has taken, it's really backfiring on him.
It's like an al-Qaeda situation. The Mujahideen that the U.S. supported in Afghanistan came back to bite the U.S. in the 9/11 attacks. This seems to be possibly something like that. Describe your feelings. You just got back from Turkey of seeing the pictures over the weekend of places and streets you know well.
I do. I have lots of family and a lot of friends in Ankara. I actually spoke to a Kurdish friend of mine. She's a human rights lawyer this morning just to make sure that she was okay. You know, she talked about how scared she is and how disheartened she is about the situation that is going on in Turkey. I had met her about 10 years ago, actually in southeastern Turkey, when she was doing a lot of pro-Kurdish activist work. And she told me that she's afraid to send her children to the playground where they might be attacked for either speaking Kurdish or for being Kurdish. There's a lot of polarization now in Turkey, and it's a very volatile situation. I know last week I talked to you and I said that people are fearing that the spread of violence will go throughout the country, and I think those fears are real now.
And the election will not be rescheduled, at least that's what we hear from the government in Ankara. Elmira Bezrali is author of From the Other Side of the World, Extraordinary Entrepreneurs, Unlikely Places, and she's co-founder of Foreign Policy Interrupted. Elmira, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, John.
The chaos on the ground in Syria is more and more being matched by the chaos in the air over the country. U.S. combat missions against Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, there are Russian airstrikes against opposition forces, French and NATO planes, surveillance drones, what's left of commercial air traffic, and now Turkey poised to strike ISIS or PKK Kurdish terrorist targets in retaliation for the Ankara bombing. The U.S. has accused Russia of running a fundamentally flawed campaign. Syrian rebels and Western governments say Russia has mainly been hitting non-ISIS targets. Former National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley.
Does it look weak to you, what Putin is doing in Syria? Putin says he's coming in to fight ISIS. In fact, what he's doing is bombing those opposition members we have supported. At the same time, they are being attacked by ISIS. So they're fighting a two-front war. And what is our policy? Our policy is to limit the amount of military assistance we provide to them and tell them they cannot attack Assad. This is lunacy.
That's Stephen Hadley speaking on Fox News Sunday. David Deptula is a retired U.S. Air Force lieutenant general, principal attack planner for the Desert Storm Coalition air campaign in 1991, now dean at the Mitchell Institute of Aerospace Studies. General, how close do you think we are to actual air-to-air combat between U.S. and Russian planes right now over Syria?
Well, actually, John, I tell you, I think that's a very remote possibility. There are a variety of different nations and organizations conducting air operations, but you're talking about an area approximately 90,000 square miles. Quite frankly, there are not a lot of U.S. coalition-led missions over Syria on any one given day. Less than 2 weeks ago, our Secretary of State announced at the UN that the U.S.-led coalition over the last year has averaged only about 8 strike sorties or missions a day in Syria. So while certainly there are more people getting involved, the potential conflicts that might occur certainly above zero, but they're not something that is going to happen relatively frequently.
Putin is testing the West in Ukraine, testing the West in the Crimea. I'm just wondering, is there the possibility of at least a challenge over Syria of competing airspace?
Well, John, I tell you that the Russians are acting in accordance with their own national security interests. That should not be a surprise to anybody. And what they're doing in Syria, quite frankly, is they're taking advantage of a less than robust U.S. military effort regarding the Islamic State to dramatically increase their presence in the Middle East. What's happened here, John, is a U.S. anemic military action against the Islamic State is what's allowed Russia to dramatically up their game in the Middle East, reversing their general practice of the last 30 years or so. And they've moved advanced surface-to-air missile systems to cover their positions in Syria. Now, the Islamic State has no air power, so this move's aimed at complicating U.S. air operations. And frankly, the Russian intervention throws the entire regional chessboard upside down. They've been coordinating with Iran, Iraq, Syria, and even the Israeli Defense Force. Plus, it diverts attention from Ukraine. So it basically shows the Russians can walk and chew gum as well as play chess.
I mean, this is beginning to look a little bit like Sarajevo 1914. I mean, something could happen because all of these players are involved that could drag all of them into some much more serious confrontation, nation to nation, over this frontier in Syria. And now with Turkey, you know, moving because of this bombing, this seems to be a prescription for a lot of jokers in the deck. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah. No, and by the way, I didn't say there's no chance. There is a chance of, you know, an incident that is something that someone doesn't anticipate because there are so many multiple actors playing in the area. And, you know, look, we ought to take a look at deconfliction measures. And there's a number of options that can be put in place, either with or without Russian cooperation. You know, and complicating this whole issue, though, is whatever deconfliction option is selected, is that the choice can have significant foreign policy implications. Now, there are lots of different alternatives that can be put in place based on geography, airspace, distance between aircraft, altitude. Now, I'd also tell you, and your audience needs to understand that, you know, U.S. aircraft flying in Syria have the benefit of great situational awareness. So, you know, they're not going to accidentally run into somebody. And given the fact that the very few sorties that were flying over Syria on a daily basis, this is more of a political issue than it is a military deconfliction challenge.
How would you describe this in general? Is this a hot piece with Russia, a mini Cold War with Russia, or is this simply Vladimir Putin with a free hand in the Middle East all of a sudden, and the U.S. is waiting for some disastrous scenario that will change the game for the U.S.?
The Russians are acting in accordance with their own national security interests here. Russia took advantage of the vacuum in leadership that the United States created in Syria. You know, the issue at hand is, what is the United States leadership going to do to reestablish a coherent, not reestablish, how about establish in the first place a coherent strategy that is responsive to U.S. national security needs?
David Deptulo is a retired U.S. Air Force general who helped plan the air attacks that won the first Gulf War in 1991. Thanks so much, David.
You bet, John. Take care.
Part of what the Russian military activity in Ukraine, Syria, and also with troop movements near the Baltic states and continued tension in Georgia and Abkhazia has shown the world is an aggressive campaign of Russian military spending on troop modernization, better equipment, and a junking of the Soviet-era hardware that was shown to be obsolete in Afghanistan back in the 70s and 80s. Last week, Russia announced it had launched 26 cruise missiles at ISIS targets in Syria from the Caspian Sea, more than 900 miles away. The more than 8,000 people who have died in the conflict in Ukraine were taken out by old-class Russian weapons, largely, an indication that Russia can easily supply militias to do its bidding in places like Ukraine, while holding back its latest technology for something else. Michael Kaufman is a public policy fellow at the Kennan Institute, a research organization focused on Ukraine and Russia. He addresses the question if this modernization is a strategy or just replacing rusty 20th century junk.
The modernization of the Russian military is really about restoring capability to what was largely a Soviet military that Russia had inherited and not been able to do much with for about 20 years. Essentially, Russia had inherited the sort of empty shell of a mass mobilization army from the Soviet Union that was completely inapplicable for any of its immediate needs. It wasn't able to function against local conflicts or crises. So it underwent a heavy reform process from 2009 to 2011 and a modernization process that goes on even till today.
Can we expect Russian special ops forces of the capability of CIA and, say, Navy SEALs or aircraft, which at one time was a strength of the Soviet military, or new Russian planes, talked about a lot on Russian media these days, are they a superior product to what was made decades ago?
Yeah, well, you know, from the perspective of aircraft, absolutely. I mean, Russia's been buying more tactical aviation, brand new aircraft, than any Western country, including the United States, frankly. And these are what are called Generation 4 Plus or 4 Plus Plus aircraft, which is, you know, about as good as you can get before you get to stealth technology. And, you know, even though they have not been buying them in large numbers, every year they have more and more. With respect to things like special forces, you know, what we call sort of tier one special forces capability, what people think of when they say Navy SEALs or Delta Force, Russia only recently founded this organization. It's called SCO, Special Operations Command, and it's debatable whether or not maybe they have 600 to 1,000 such operators, but we first saw them in Crimea, and most likely they're on the ground in Syria today as well.
What do you think of the naval forces? The Russian Navy at Sevastopol was considered to be something of a rusting heap for many, many years. Again, a leftover from the Soviet era. But are they developing the same kind of technology that, say, our Aegis cruisers have, with huge sort of so-called radar awareness of entire oceans simultaneously?
So the thing about the shipbuilding program is Russia has outstanding submarine construction and great submarines. When it comes to surface ships, Russia's had quite a hard time. Right now, for years now, they've been working on the first part of a shipbuilding renovation, essentially focusing on smaller classes of ships, frigates and corvettes. It's less about the ships. It's really that, you know, it's the year 2015, and Russia's really put out an entire new generation of capabilities, that is, missiles, anti-ship missiles, land attack missiles, which you just saw fired from the Caspian last week, surface-to-air missiles, surface-to-surface ballistic missiles, and long-range air-to-surface missiles. So what's happening is Russia's navy, by size, is getting smaller. But the missiles that are going on them are having amazing reach, much better capability. So you can actually have a smaller ship with a whole lot of range and firepower and what it can do.
So what do you think the Syrian air campaign, the fighting in eastern Ukraine, and to a lesser extent, some of these breakaway territories in Georgia and Abkhazia, for instance, and even the front lines of the Baltics, what are they showcasing in the glimpses of this new military that's coming into focus right now as you see it?
So in Crimea, there's not much you can take except that Russia has really good capability to command its forces, and modernization is a big part of that. One thing people don't realize very much is that using special forces is a lot about, it's about communications. It's about having secure communications and being able to command small units, which is not that easy. It's not just about having them. In Ukraine, you know, in eastern Ukraine, what we see is that, you know, Russia's military is not operating as a military. It's operating in these sort of specially tasked, organized, what we call battalion tactical groups, right, which is pieces of its force coming in. And these are sort of the cream of the crop contract troops being used from the airborne or naval infantry. But we're not really seeing Russia's army fight as an army. What it tells us, though, technologically from a capability standpoint, is that Russia's not using any of its latest and greatest in Ukraine. Russia's military shows that it has, even its sort of middling capability is good enough to take on any former Soviet country. It could take on any neighbor and beat any neighbor with even a semi-modernized, slightly upgraded military, not even using the latest technology.
Would you describe the U.S. relationship confrontation with the Russians right now as a hot piece, a new Cold War, or something fundamentally different?
No, I think it's something fundamentally different. You know, I think that we're definitely not going there, although I do think that the sort of period of confrontation, Russia is a lot more comfortable with it than the last 24 years of cyclical relations, for sure.
Michael Kaufman is a public policy fellow at the Kennan Institute, a research organization focused on Ukraine and Russia. Michael Kaufman, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. My pleasure.
White scarves, peaceful gathering of women on the steps of a plaza in Buenos Aires, Argentina. These images became the political force of grief and anger that eventually helped bring down the Argentine military dictatorship in the early 1980s. They gathered each week, the mothers and grandmothers of the Plaza Maya, or the Madres de Abuelas de la Plaza de Mayo, to demand to know where their children, abducted by the government, were.
I buried Laura. I knew where Laura was, but I didn't know where my grandson was.
Estela de Carlotto formed the group of mothers. She also helped coin a name, Los Desaparecidos, the disappeared, to describe their missing children and grandchildren. Besides helping to bring down the government, they've also tracked down hundreds of missing grandchildren, including Estela's. their tragedy and success are the subject of this month's Retro Report from the New York Times. Joining me now is Barbara Dury, producer for Retro Report. Barbara, welcome.
Thank you.
Describe for us the government, the military dictatorship of Argentina in those days.
In those days, it was a very brutal government, and they came in, and a lot of people were very happy that they were there. There had been some guerrilla activity. There had been one incident of a bomb. People became afraid. So there was a very strong right side that thought, you know, maybe we need to crack down. But they had no idea that they were coming in to take people and kill them.
And disappeared is quite literally what happened, the idea of the disappeared. Here, listen.
The military went to where the person worked or to university, or maybe the person was walking in the street, and then it's like the earth had swallowed them.
And that's a description from Isabel Mignone de Carril. What's she describing there? Her experience of her family?
She's describing the experience of her family. Her sister was 26 years old when they came to the house. They were all there. Her sister was older, and she was taken. And they expected her to be returned. In fact, her mother had said to them, "Should I give her bus money to come home?" Hmm. And they said, "Yes, give her the bus money." And they never heard from her again.
And some of these people were born in captivity, in a sense, the result of pregnant women being taken captive.
Pregnant women. They figured out quickly that there were some pregnant women, and they let them give birth. Even they couldn't, even in their brutality, they couldn't take them and kill them because of the unborn children. And they felt that they could take these children, give them to sympathetic families who were sympathetic to the regime, and that they would raise them, you know, in these proper homes and bring them up properly, and they would never know. They would never know who their real parents were and what had happened to them.
The positive story here are the reunions, and here's one.
When I met my grandson and I could hug him, he doesn't look like his mother, but I knew that in his blood was my daughter Laura, and it was like I got her back.
Who would have expected that Estela de Carlotto, who is the leader of this entire movement, would actually be reunited with her grandson?
I think it was a big shock to her as well. She never gave up hope. She's a very tenacious, strong woman. And they started searching when they were infants. They went to homes looking for people, babies, then children, then young adults, then adults. And this cycle has gone on for nearly four decades. So she was not expecting it. She was hoping for it because she's about to turn 85. But I'm not sure she thought it.
Barbara Dury is a producer for Retro Report. You can see her work at thetakeaway.org. Barbara, thanks so much.
Thank you.
In Cleveland, though, the use of force against 12-year-old Tamir Rice, shot dead by police last November, was deemed reasonable. The child looked like a possible threat for carrying a pellet gun, according to two independent reviewers. The Cuyahoga County prosecutor says a grand jury will decide whether Officer Timothy Lohman and his partner Frank Garmbach will face charges. WKSU's Kabir Bhatia has been following developments. Welcome, Kabir.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
So we've heard your voice on NPR. You've really sort of taken this case everywhere in public media since it broke. I'm curious about these independent reviewers here. They're both prosecutors or prosecutor-oriented folks?
Well, they are. One's a retired FBI agent. One is currently a Denver prosecutor, and they were commissioned to do these reports by the Cuyahoga County prosecutor independently. And their findings both found that Officer Lohman had a reasonable reason to believe that he was under threat from Tamir Rice.
Did the prosecutor's office in Cuyahoga County believe that these independent reviews would calm things down? Because that doesn't seem to have been the effect.
I'm not sure if calming things down is part of their mission statement, but by releasing them, they said they wanted to keep things transparent, keep the investigation transparent, and keep the public informed. So I guess in a way that could be said that it would keep things calm so that there was a feeling that, yes, things are moving forward transparently, things are happening. But I think you're correct in assessing that this may have not had the intended effect, especially with the Rice family's attorneys. It's not sitting well with them.
Well, this notion of transparency is also kind of cynical in the sense that we go from these independent reviewers who have a prosecutorial orientation, as you've said, to a secret grand jury, which the family has said will now be cleared to essentially exonerate these officers. Now, of course, that's the family's view. We'll have to wait and see. But is that the feeling on the street in Cleveland?
Seems to be somewhat. The people, I mean, this came out on a Saturday night during a holiday weekend. I'm not sure how much of this information has even reached the street, so to speak. The feeling, especially given the statements from the Rice family's attorneys, is that it's avoiding accountability for the prosecutor's office, even though the prosecutor, by saying they're releasing this to be transparent, feels that they're doing the exact opposite. And the attorneys say almost that this was a step to whitewash. They feel that there was enough evidence, even in June, before the sheriff's department's report came out, there was enough evidence then to indict, in the words of the Rice family's attorneys.
Would a grand jury decision not to indict essentially exonerate these officers? Does it end there? Would they have civil options, the family, and are there federal investigations possibly looming here?
Well, federally, there's, of course, the consent decree, and I'm sure that this is being looked at as part of that. But from a civil standpoint, they've said that there are many things that have come out in the investigation that in a civil suit might be looked at. For example, there's no audio on the one surveillance tape of what happened. And various witnesses have said different things, whether the officers shouted commands, whether they didn't. There's the question of what was passed on from the 911 dispatcher to the officers. And all of that would likely come up in a civil suit.
Tension in Cleveland before we go?
Tension for the last, I'd say, year and a half when it comes to things like this. With the consent decree coming out, there's the hope, I guess, on the part of the public that the department will be making some sort of reforms, changes. There's a panel that's coming up that's going to be looking at all of that. So always tension, but possibly we're looking optimistically at that.
Looking optimistically from WKSU. Kabir Bhaktia is reporting on the Tamir Rice case in Cleveland, Ohio. Kabir, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thinking about all the passionate discussions we heard from you and others last week regarding guns in America and security in schools, here's a question that has not surprisingly popped up this fall. Do teachers and professors want to carry weapons in school? What's more, do teachers increasingly fear gun violence to the point that they're just questioning their decision to become teachers at all? Daniel Hammermesh is a professor emeritus of economics who still works at the University of Texas, Austin. He announced he would withdraw from his position and will be done after teaching this fall. Professor Hammermesh, describe your decision, how you came to it, and how many students is it going to affect?
Well, I have lots of opportunities to teach elsewhere, and when the gun law allowing carry in classrooms and offices was passed, it made me think I should exercise those opportunities. So at 72, I have lots of opportunities still. I have a nice pension. I just don't want to bear the increased risk of facing a student in my office who gets disgruntled and pulls a gun out on me.
Well, I can certainly understand that. And your emeritus position still allows you to teach under contract, and it's this contract that you're ending, right, because of your fears.
That's exactly right. And let me stress, the fear is not a huge fear, but it's an enhanced fear, enhanced partly by the law and partly by the fact that my class has 500 students. You know, the chance that one of them might really sort of flip out in my office and pull a gun on me.
And you're talking about something that, you know, when you're lying in bed at night, this is something that really does haunt your dreams.
It's not as much lying in bed at night. That I don't worry about it. But what I do worry about is the feeling of tension that this would engender, because somebody might do something and you're always going to be on the alert. And I don't need to put up with that. I mean, life is short. I don't need the money that much. I'd rather do other things.
And there are Nobel laureates at the University of Texas. How many people do you think are on the margins, sort of at the end of their career, carrying huge, you know, experience as teachers, and the kind of people that attract students who are going to make a decision like this, do you think? Just, I know it's speculation, but who, there's no, you're not the only one.
I'm sure I'm not the only one, but it's probably easier for me than almost anybody else on this campus to do for a whole variety of reasons. I think the bigger concern is people who are like 45, who are real stars, the kinds of persons that this university ought to be trying to recruit, who have lots of opportunities. And why take even a slight risk as the opportunity at UT when you can go elsewhere? So that's the way it costs the university.
I mean, does the president say, we'll just, you know, hand out Kevlar vests at orientation for teachers to attract them here? What's the reaction of President Fenves?
Well, let's start first of all with his superior, who's a chancellor of the university system, who was very vehement and just quite outspoken. He's a Navy admiral, by the way, against this legislation when it was being debated last spring. Right now, the president is holding a bunch of forums and has a committee designed to decide what they could limit as places you can't carry guns. But, I mean, the general limit, saying no guns in offices, I don't think that's going to happen. And similarly, no guns in classrooms, that's not going to happen either. They can't do that politically, given what the legislation was passed as. I'm sure that President Fenves would like to do more limitations than, in fact, are politically feasible.
Describe the conversations you've had among your colleagues. What do they say about all this? I mean, is it just a roll your eyes, this is Texas kind of thing? Or is this really something that goes against the spirit of academic freedom and a sense of an open forum for the exchange of ideas?
I think that's exactly it. A lot of people, especially in the humanities departments, are terribly concerned that, you know, why express something that might be controversial and over which a student might get really, really upset when there's an increased risk of having a student pull a gun on you? And I think that's quite reasonable. That's not my concern. My concern is just a heightened sense of tension on the campus and the feeling that somebody always might be going, flipping out and taking out a gun at you. It makes it a less desirable place for learning. It makes it less of a learning environment. It also impinges upon my freedom to operate in my classroom exactly as I want. I view my classroom and my office as my castle. Mm. And I don't like the legislature telling me what can go on in my castle. It's just, I see no argument for it at all, nor do I see the argument that, well, you know, it would all be safer if all the professors had guns. I don't want to have a gun. I don't want to be involved in shooting at somebody who happens to draw first. I'm probably too old to draw fast anyway. My reactions are slow. And having a gun would just make my life worse in so many, many ways.
Do you know professors who have said, no, I have a conceal and carry, and I think it's a fine idea?
I've had a couple of professors saying they're pro-gun, but they do not want them on campus. They understand that this does alter the learning environment here. Those are the only negative comments I've gotten. Actually, just one professor said that. The only other negative comment from a professor, this ignores all the absolute scurrilous hate mail I've received, is from one professor who said by doing this hurts the University of Texas because it publicizes this kind of thing.
And the tension on campuses, particularly a place like UT Austin, is well documented with the suicide rates and, you know, the emotional tensions that students are under. So, you know, this really does seem to heap flammable material on an already smoldering situation. Do people have a sense that, you know, students are on the edge emotionally in many, many cases?
It's hard to see that they're on the edge emotionally, all of them. But remember, there are 38,000, I believe, undergraduates here. It doesn't take very many who, with guns in their pocket, could make life quite miserable for people. Again, it's the size of the university, the closeness together of the people, their age, and in my own case, it's the number of students whom I face each year I teach this class.
And the bullet marks on the buildings from the shooter in the tower.
The shooter in the tower, I certainly remember that, August 1, 1966. And it is a very, very interesting coincidence that the legislature, in its wisdom, passed this law to go into effect on the 50th anniversary of the tower shooting, which I find just remarkable.
Professor Hammermisch, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Daniel Hammermisch is a professor in the Department of Economics, the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin. Here's a bit of news from 1980 and songwriter slash reporter Joe Jackson looking sharp.
It's so good to be back here in England, where you have a sophisticated standard of journalism, you know, with papers like the New Musical Express. And of course, the Sunday papers.
Mother doesn't go out anymore. just sits at home and rolls her spastic eyes.
Joe Jackson's band, just like the even angrier sounding Clash in the early 80s, made their songs about the news of the day. Unusual for pop bands, but then Joe Jackson has always been unusual.
I once had a beer with Joe Strummer, and he told me that when him and Mick Jones were writing those songs for the Clash, a lot of the time they were taking the piss, as we say in England, you know, making fun. And when the rock critics would analyze them and take them very seriously as political and social commentary, they would be cracking up laughing. And I completely related to that.
Jackson loves to shrug off serious inquiries about his songs, but no one doubts he's a serious musician and a lyricist who excels exploring the territory of band leaders like Duke Ellington, poets like Walt Whitman, traveling America and commenting on all its good and bad. Jackson's first original song album in 7 years displays his love of songs, his eye-rolling annoyance at pop formulas, but delivers his sharp eye for detail and storytelling that have made Joe Jackson a musical legend for more than 30 years.
There's three classic themes of pop songwriting. One is I'm so happy because I'm in love.
I'm in love and you.
And number two is I'm devastated because my baby left me. And the third one is, oh, to hell with it, let's just dance and have a good time.
We can dance, we can dance,
that's it, boo.
There's nothing wrong with any of those themes,
no.
You know, but I try to think of something else. That's all.
I mean, when you do go into some of those themes, you find a different way of talking about it. Let's take, for instance, something breaking us in two.
Don't you feel like trying something new? Don't you feel like breaking?
It's not a breakup song. It's about, I don't know, it's sort of about the complexities of a relationship.
Yeah, yeah, like no matter how close you get to someone, there's always something that holds you apart. I think I'm sort of attracted to slightly ambiguous themes, you know, or bittersweet. A lot of my songs are bittersweet, I think. And it's interesting because some people hear them as sad and other people hear them as happy. And to me, they're both.
Hometown, is that about a particular town?
Yeah, it's about my hometown, which is Portsmouth on the south coast of England. But that was a kind of deliberate exercise in nostalgia. I thought, can I write a nostalgic song? You know, I always think of it as sort of like a recreational drug. It's all right to indulge in a little bit, but, you know, you've got to be careful.
I mean, I searched and searched your work. There is no evidence at all that you have any nostalgia for Portsmouth.
No. Yeah, it's a pretty horrible place, really. I mean, but at the same time, only your hometown is your hometown,
right?
You know, and I still go back quite a lot, and I still have some friends there and family and so on.
I associate your early work with an emotional portrait of Thatcher's England.
Oh my God! Really?
Not like the Clash, who were very, you know, sort of out there and political. It seemed to me that you really captured a sense of, I don't know, heartbreak that came in Thatcher's England.
I think you give me too much credit, actually. I mean, thanks, but
I give a lot of people too much credit.
I mean, so much of what I wrote back then was very tongue-in-cheek and humorous, but it was seen as being angry, I think, because that was the zeitgeist of the time, and people saw what they were looking for.
This album is a passionate reemergence for you. It's set in different places, attempting to capture and portray four different cities and styles of music.
If it wasn't for you, my friend, why should everything be such a fuss? We were brought up in a boring town. I agree.
eyes, but not for me. Jockey Diva, won't you sing for me?
The idea of recording in different cities came quite late in the day because I had a sort of unmanageable pile of songs that was accumulating. And I was looking for some kind of way to organize them. And the idea surfaced in a conversation I was having with my manager, actually, that maybe I didn't have to do an album. You know, maybe I could do an EP or just do three or four songs and then move on and do another three or four. And I thought that was quite an interesting idea. Started thinking about places that I might like to work and musicians that I might like to work with. And the musicians are actually more important than the places. I mean, they're all cities that I know very well, you know, but the main thing that took me to those places was the musicians.
What are the places?
New York, New Orleans, Berlin, and Amsterdam.
How do you see an arrangement? Because I think of you as such an arranger. Part of the composing process is the arranging process. How do you see the landscape of the instrumentation and the things that you'll do, particularly when you decide to change it up?
Sometimes when you decide not to do certain things, it makes you use your imagination more. I mean, for a long time, I toured with just a trio, just me and bass and drums. And it's so interesting because when you're limited, it forces you to use your imagination more. And it just seems to get bigger and bigger. You know, the more I worked with the trio, the freer it seemed, the more possibilities there were.
And you were on keyboards?
Yeah.
And does it make your piano playing better because you have to use it to do everything?
I think I've gotten generally better, actually. In recent years, I think my piano playing has improved quite a lot.
Well, is there something limiting about the genre? Right now,
of what?
Of popular song, of albums. I mean, I associate your work with you really loved the kind of novelistic quality of an album, of an LP.
Yeah.
And now that's kind of disrupted with all the downloading and stuff.
Yeah. I mean, it sort of is and it isn't. It's very confusing, really, because people keep talking about how the album is dead, and yet people keep making albums. And I think that the concept of an album, regardless of what it is physically or whether it is a physical object or not, I think the concept of an album is still there, you know, as far as it being an artist's, like, a kind of statement of where they're at that point in time, and something bigger than just a song. I think somehow the idea of an album still exists.
Thanks a lot, Joe.
Thank you.
Joe Jackson's new album, Fast Forward, is out now. That's all for us today. If you want to take the takeaway with you, subscribe to our podcast. Find us on iTunes. Take us with you on your commute home from work or wherever. A great way to stay up on the news. Again, find us on iTunes or any other service you use. Thanks so much for listening and enriching your conversation. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. Someone else might come.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.